Hi there, this is Paul Anka. On the station, it sounds great to me. That's 88.3 Southern FM, where they do things my way.
And coming up right now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, Mercury Redstone 4 and Gemini 10. We look back 55 and 50 years respectively. And please get your diary handy because we have at least one entry for it. Well, we're getting into the show in just a moment, but first let's hear from Charlie Duke.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon, and you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, it's 55 years ago, July 21, tomorrow our time, which means that there's a spacecraft launch, the second American man into space. This was Virgil I. Grissom, I for Ivan, and everyone called him Gus Grissom. And the flight was officially called Mercury Redstone 4. It had the Mercury 4 capsule, otherwise known as Liberty Bell 7. Now, this was a suborbital flight, which means it didn't go into orbit. It went up and down. It lasted 15 minutes and 37 seconds, reached an altitude of 190 kilometres and a range of 487 kilometres. But at the end of the flight, the capsule sank. Well, before the mission, Gus Grissom was asked by a reporter from the Voice of America to describe his training for weightlessness. And here's the response that he gave.
From your own experience now, Gus, that is from your own experience and training, could you give us your own first-hand account of the experience in the air when there is no weight, the sense of weightlessness, that feeling of free-floating?
Well, I've been asked many times to describe how I feel in a weightless state, and it's difficult. It's a pleasant sensation. It's sort of like floating on cloud nine is about the best way I can express it. There's nothing unpleasant about it at all.
Are you saddled down, so to speak, firmly strapped and so on in this period of free-floating, the weightless period of flight?
In the training we've done, we have encountered weightlessness in both ways. In the F-100 aircraft, while we were strapped in, this was a time when we were getting a period of weightlessness of about 1 minute. Now, we flew in two other airplanes where we were completely free and permitted to float in the cabin and for periods up to about 30 seconds. So we've encountered weightlessness in both conditions, strapped down and free floating.
In this period of tests, have you had the opportunity to check out the problems of eating, for example, and drinking, and so on?
Well, this was part of the weightless program, eating, drinking, using tools, moving, and problems and disorientation and this sort of thing.
And what have been the results from the tests?
Well, in a weightless condition, you have to learn to do things a little differently. But we really don't see any problem, at least not in the time periods that we've been weightless.
Well, does that mean that these, for example, food and so on, has to be served up in toothpaste tubes, for example, and so on, in order to keep them?
It's true that the food has to be packaged a little differently. Otherwise, crumbs get around the cockpit, and water has to be in a tube so that you can control it all the way. But again, this doesn't appear to be any real problem.
What about the human constitution as far as food and so on in this period of free-floating or weightlessness?
Well, again, about all I can say is I don't see any problem. Everything appears to function pretty normally.
From some of your other tests, what are the effects acceleration from your own experience?
From our training on the centrifuge, we have undergone the G's that we expect on launch and reentry and during some of the aborted missions.
Well, that was 50 years ago, before the first Mercury flight. And at that time, Gus Grissom was hoping to be the first into space. And it's true now. People often ask astronauts, why did you become an astronaut? And the Voice of America reporter at the time was no exception.
Can you tell us, Gus, what made you volunteer for this program?
Well, sort of seemed a natural thing to do. I don't know that I had any specific reason. I had a very good job in flight test that I like very much, but this seemed like a wonderful opportunity to serve the country and continue in the work I'd been doing, and so it's just a natural thing for me to do.
What do you feel that you have contributed now to the Mercury program as a result of your training?
Well, I guess the biggest thing I've contributed has been my operational experience in flying and flight tests.
If you are selected and become the first U.S. astronaut in space, what are your next plans?
Well, I've been so busy I haven't made plans beyond this.
Are you a hero, Gus, a Superman? After all these tests and so on, they finally selected you, seven, and now you, now the three that have been selected for the specialized training. Can you say that you're a hero now, a Superman?
No, I'm certainly not a Superman or a hero. I'm just like all the other fellows in flight tests in the Air Force that I've worked with for a good number of years.
From your own experience here now, Gus, what makes an astronaut?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question, I don't believe. That's pretty much a day-to-day job, and you come to work like everybody else, and you work the things that have to be done. We spend probably a third to half of our time in training and the rest of the time in engineering. And I don't know what makes an astronaut, I guess.
What will it mean, Gus? Let me put it this way. How will you feel, or why do you want to be the first U.S. astronaut?
Well, just seems sort of natural to want to be first to do anything. And then again, as I've said before, it's a natural extension of what I've been doing, and there is a certain professional reputation to be made as being a test pilot and an astronaut, and so probably look forward to it on these grounds as much as anything.
And that was Gus Grissom speaking before his flight. And as you heard, he didn't become the first person in space, not even the first American in space, but the second, and that only on a suborbital flight. Well, we now turn our attention to the actual flight, and here's how the liftoff was called by what we now call Mission Control.
Ignition, liftoff, lift.
Mercury Control and pilot.
Roger, this is Liberty Apollo 7. The clock is operating.
Loud and clear, Jose. Don't cry too much.
Okie doke.
And shortly after that, as he was going up towards the maximum altitude, he was heard to say this.
Okay, it's a nice ride up to now.
Loud and clear.
Roger. Okay, the fuel is go, about 1.25 G's. Cabin pressure is just coming off the peg. The oxygen is go with 26 amps.
Roger, pitch 8-8, trajectory is good.
Roger, looks good here.
The announcer at Mission Control was Shorty Powers.
We're advised that as a result of communications with Gus Grissom floating in the water, he's told his recovery helicopters that he intends to finish his checklist and make sure that everything is secure in the cockpit before he opens the hatch to come out. And this sounds like typical Gus Grissom. He was not about to do anything until he was sure everything had been done and in a businesslike manner.
And then we were waiting for the rescue people to lift up the capsule and take it to the aircraft carrier, when suddenly, bam, the hatch went off, and immediately Gus Grissom came out and was floating in the water, and the water began to go into his spacesuit, because he had his helmet off by this time, and he nearly drowned. The helicopter had a grip on the capsule, but unfortunately its engine began to overheat, and it couldn't lift up the combined weight of the water, which had now entered the capsule, plus the capsule itself, and as a result they had to jettison the capsule, and it sank down into the Atlantic Ocean. At the press conference after the mission, Grissom had this to say about that event.
So I was all set, waiting for him, laid back down on the couch. He gave me a call. He was on final, and I knew he'd be in to pick me up in about 10 or 15 seconds. I was just laying there minding my own business, and then, pow, the hatch went. I looked up, and I saw nothing but blue sky and water starting to come in over the sill. So I tossed my helmet off, and the only two moves I remember making was tossing my helmet off and grabbing the instrument panel and pulling myself out. I only remember grabbing the instrument panel. I don't even remember going out the door. But the chopper pilot said the door came off immediately, followed by myself.
That hatch ejection and the subsequent sinking of the Liberty Bell remains controversial to this day. When the capsule was eventually salvaged in 1999, it had been hoped clues to solve the mystery might be evident. Had the hatch ejected on its own, or did Gus Grissom activate the explosions and eject the hatch himself? Gus always denied having done it himself. He said it was something that happened spontaneously. Well, when they picked it up out of the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean in 1999, the craft was too corroded to provide a definitive answer.
In all the history books of the future, it will be written that man, in 1961, broke his earth fetters and soared into space. Two Americans achieved suborbital flights. Two Soviet cosmonauts spun around the world in orbital flights. And while in years to come new flights will take man to the moon and the planets beyond, this was the year, nevertheless, when it all began. When man overcame his biological limitations and boldly challenged the unknown of outer space.
That was from the Voice of America, which had a proud tradition of covering all of the American manned space flights.
Then in July, American space scientists enacted the drama all over again and sent their second man into space from the sands of Cape Canaveral. He was astronaut Virgil Grissom, and here are his impressions of his journey, told to news reporters the following day.
I could see the sun shining through the window, and then the horizon came into view with the Earth. And this is a thing that was really, really fascinating. I don't know how to describe it, but the Earth was very bright. At this time, I couldn't see any land. I could see the horizon, a very round horizon.
Now, Gus Grissom did achieve a first. He had wanted to be the first person in space, at least the first American, but he did achieve the first, along with John Young, and that was to fly the Gemini two-manned spacecraft, and that was Gemini 3 in 1965. Gus was also named to command the first Apollo manned flight, which was to have been an orbital mission. He and his two crewmates died when what would have been Apollo 1 caught fire on the launch pad in 1967 during a training rehearsal. Well, that flight was in 1961, July the 21st. And on that same day, President John Kennedy signed the NASA authorization bill, just hours after Gus Grissom's suborbital flight, and 8 years to the day before Apollo 11 made the first human landing on the moon.
It is a pleasure to sign today the authorization bill for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. This bill has been approved by the Congress in an overwhelming manner and demonstrates united support for a new and vigorous space program submitted to our country by the Vice President as Chairman of the National Aeronautic and Space Council, sent to the Congress by me as President and given overwhelming support by members of both of our parties who are committed, as we all are, to seeing to it that the United States occupies an important position in the race into the far reaches of space. It is especially fitting that this bill should be signed on this day that our second astronaut, Captain Virgil Grissom, who I spoke to this morning after he had made his successful flight, I think it's most important that we should have once again this emphasis on the leadership which our fellow Americans are showing in this field, their courage, and also the strong scientific support that they've received from the entire American scientific community. It's significant also that this flight was made before the eyes of the watching world, with all the hazard that that entails. As our space program continues on even more ambitious missions, it will continue to be this nation's policy to use space for the advancement of all mankind and to make free release of all scientific and technological results. And therefore, it is with great pleasure that we sign it today.
And that authorization gave NASA, along with authorizations in subsequent years, the money that it needed to take humans to the moon. And we're going to hear more about that later in the show. But first, these announcements.
The best variety on your radio, 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are looking at some significant anniversaries. And, yes, July 20, another auspicious date. Viking 1 was launched in 1975, August the 20th. It went into orbit around Mars in 1976, June the 19th, and after doing a photographic survey, it separated into two parts, an orbiter and a lander. And the lander landed, yes, 1976, July 20, just 40 years ago. It operated for 6 years, but contact was lost when a faulty command was sent from Earth. There was a sister craft called Viking 2. It was launched in 1975, September the 9th, and went into orbit in 1976, August the 7th, and landed in 1976, September the 3rd. Well, NASA is hosting several commemorative events this week, 40 years ago for Viking on Mars. On The Space Show, we're looking at some anniversaries, particularly in manned spaceflight. So why don't we have a song now? We Are the Spacemen, and this is sung by Cody Calhoun and Spacemen. We are the spacemen. Spacemen. Yes, 48 years ago, Mike Collins was the command module pilot on Apollo 11. And as such, he didn't land on the moon, but instead remained alone in orbit around the moon. Well, 50 years ago this week, Michael Collins was in Earth orbit aboard Gemini 10. He was with John Young, and they made 43 orbits in Gemini 10. They launched on July 18 and landed on July 21. That was 70 hours, 46 minutes, and 39 seconds. Yes, they timed space flights down to the second. They used an Agena D to propel them to what was then a record height of 763 kilometers. And they rendezvoused with another Agena D, which had been left by Gemini 8. That's the one that spun out of control with Neil Armstrong aboard. Now, Collins made a stand-up EVA to retrieve an experiment, and he made the craziest spacewalk ever in spaceflight history when he went across from his own spacecraft, Gemini 10, to the Agena D from Gemini 8. And he lost control and spun out of control and came back to the capsule, sprang back. Conservation of angular momentum meant he was going to wrap around the capsule going faster and faster and crash into it, but he managed to use a little gun to get control. He lost a camera that would have been taken spectacular photos of the event. Anyway, he got all back inside the capsule okay, and they landed in the Atlantic Ocean, some 851 kilometers due east of Cape Canaveral.
Gemini has done much more to open the way to the moon than we could have hoped for 5 years ago, and has given this country an operational spacecraft important to national defense. With Gemini, we've developed our ability to maneuver in space, to change orbits, to inspect other objects in space, to rendezvous and dock, and to use the power of an orbiting rocket as a switch engine in space. Gemini has supported men in space in good health for twice as long as it takes to get to the moon and back. And Gemini has brought the astronauts safely and precisely to Earth whenever required under both normal and emergency conditions. Gemini has enabled the astronauts themselves to demonstrate their ability to function effectively in and out of their spacecraft and to serve as test pilots in a variety of new space operations and to attend to significant scientific and technological experiments. In the mission we're going to look at more closely today, the astronauts proved their skill in carrying out two rendezvous maneuvers. In the second, when they converged on the Agena left from Gemini 8, they tracked optically without the assistance of radar. They used the Agena as a switch engine to travel further into space than man has to date. And they collected a micrometeorite experiment from Agena 8 that had been exposed to the space environment since last March. This required Major Collins to operate outside the spacecraft a second time. Gemini has demonstrated the feasibility of almost everything we plan to do in Apollo, except land softly on the moon and return safely through the Earth's atmosphere at 25,000 miles an hour. Saturn V is required to inject Apollo into the atmosphere at such speeds. But in parallel programs, the Project Fire test and the first Apollo flight with the advanced Saturn I have already gone a long way toward proving the design of the Apollo heat shield. And Surveyor has demonstrated techniques for a soft landing on the moon and for effective operation from the lunar surface. Perhaps most important of all, in 8-man Gemini flights and two more to come, we're amassing a great wealth of operating experience and operating skills. It would be difficult to overstate what it means to the American space effort to be starting the Apollo program with Gemini experience already available to us. We will open the manned flight phase of the Apollo program with a seasoned team with letter men at key positions.
But here is John Young in space announcing that he has the Agena in sight.
Gemini 10, Houston. See anything of the Agena 8 around? Fantastic, John.
Yeah, I don't believe it myself.
And then, having docked with the Agena from the Agena 10, they then used the engine of the Agena to boost themselves up to the record height.
Now we show us coming up on Hawaii for the first primary propulsion system burn. Mike threw the switch, and a minute and 24 seconds later, boy, it was really something. We had a negative 1G, and we were driven forward in the cockpit, and for 11 seconds, we got a tremendous thrill. The colors are just beautiful. And here we are, on our way to apogee, and to a new world's altitude record. And I might say that it was set incidental to doing our job, of which I'm extremely proud.
And after the mission, Mike Collins had this comment to make about his extravehicular activity, the spacewalk that he made.
A considerable portion of your attention must be devoted to holding your body in a position which is temporarily advantageous for the type of work you're doing in. And I think this is the basic problem in EVA. Without some sort of handholds or restraining devices, a large percentage of the astronaut's time is going to be devoted to torquing his body around until it's in the proper position to do some useful work. And in this process of torquing your body around, you usually find that you overshoot and bounce back, and you sort of sway back and forth and rotate around in the proximity of your job site, but it's extremely difficult to damp out all emotions and to hold yourself motionless. Really, I found I was never absolutely motionless in trying to perform a task, that I was constantly moving back and forth in front of and across the particular job site that I was interested in.
By the time of Gemini 10 in 1966, John Young had already flown Gemini 3. He went on to fly twice to the moon, orbiting on Apollo 10 and orbiting and then landing on Apollo 16. He went on to fly STS-1, the first space shuttle mission, in 1981, and STS-9 in 1983. And you can hear a talk by John Young on our website, which is space.southernfm.com.au. So go to our list of names and scroll down to Young, and you'll find John Young's talk that he gave in Canberra there. Now, the best account of Gemini 10 mission that I've ever read was written by Michael Collins himself in the book Liftoff. In 17 pages of the 288-page book, Collins gives a first-hand description of the most thrilling of all the 10 manned Gemini missions. Now, Liftoff was published by Grove Press of New York in 1988, and it has hand-drawn illustrations rather than photographs, which is quite a pleasure. So look it up, Liftoff, published by Grove Press, written by Mike Collins. Well, now we're going to hear from the original spacemen. This is a group from the United States. And although this is written for the Gemini 4 mission, it equally as well describes the Gemini 10 spacewalks. This is called Spacewalking by the Original Spacemen.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We have more from Gene Cernan coming up in the show, but first we're joined now by Peter Owood from the Space Association of Australia.
Good evening, Andrew and listeners.
And Peter, Space Association has a meeting coming up on Monday. What is it?
Yes, it's our regular fourth Monday of the month meeting, free meeting, which is coming up this coming Monday, the 25th of July. And we've got a special report from a couple of members that went over to SpaceFest number 7, which is over in the US. And Space Fest, for those who don't know, is a semi-annual gathering of space enthusiasts, artists, engineers, scientists, a lot of astronauts. It's kind of their main reunion sort of event each year. And you can buy things from astronauts, you can get things signed, you can go to lectures on different subjects of history and current projects that are happening, you know, Mars projects, etc. So two of our members went over there, and they're going to relay their stories, show a few pictures of the people and the things that they've done. Actually, one of the members went on a road trip afterwards and went to various Air Force bases, abandoned rocket missile silos, and all sorts of things. I think he might have even gone to Area 51 to take a look at all the aliens. I'm not supposed to say that. The things that are there. So, yeah, it should be a really good meeting, as per usual. It's at the Elstermick, or the Caulfield RSL, which is actually not Elstermick, on 4 St. George's Road, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Monday night, the 25th. It's free. You just go through the front door, do an immediate U-turn and go up the stairs to the first floor, and you'll find us there. You can have a drink, order a meal downstairs, and just tell them you want it to deliver it upstairs, and they'll take it up for you at sort of RSL prices. And introduce yourself around, and we're a friendly bunch, and it should be a really good night.
Thank you, Peter. Peter from the Space Association of Australia. And you're on the Space Show on 88.3 Southern FM.
I'm Len Bondurant. We talk with former astronaut Michael Collins, who was on the first manned mission to land on the moon. That mission is called Apollo 11, and it culminated in one of the most significant events in known history. His two companions, astronauts Neil A. Armstrong and Edwin E. Buzz Aldrin, were the first two human beings to walk on the moon's surface. The mission took place from July 16 to 24, 1969. It lasted 195 hours, 18 minutes, and 35 seconds. As called for by the mission plan, Collins did not descend to the moon's surface, but remained in lunar orbit with the command module. We're almost ready to go to the interview I had with Michael Collins, following the publication of his second book, Liftoff. But first, here's a little background on Collins.
Wherever I can go.
Michael Collins is a retired Major General in the U.S. Air Force Reserve. He was born October 31, 1930, in Rome, Italy. He earned a Bachelor of Science from U.S. Military Academy. Besides Apollo 11, he flew on the Gemini 10 Earth Orbital Mission, which was preparatory for Apollo missions. Collins walked in space during the Gemini 10 mission for 1 hour and 30 minutes. Astronaut John Young flew with him on that mission, which lasted from July 18th to July 21st, 1966. Now let's go to my interview with Collins when I ask him what he was trying to accomplish with his latest book, Liftoff.
Well, I think people have very short memories, and I thought it might be interesting to go back 20 years or so, 19 years it's been already since the first lunar landing, but to go back to the time of John F. Kennedy when he first started Project Apollo by saying he wanted to send a man to the moon and return him safely to Earth by the end of the decade, the decade being the 1960s. And I thought it would be kind of nice to put down in sequential order some of the preparatory steps, Project Mercury, Project Gemini, Project Apollo, and to talk a little bit about those machines and how they worked, but also to talk about the people who put them together, the people who flew them, and then just to keep that going right on up through Skylab, the shuttle, an examination of where NASA is today, and then some possibilities for the future. So that's fundamentally what the book's about.
Mike, looking back to the days of the Gemini and the Apollo programs to today's flight of the shuttle, what do you see as some differences as related to astronaut training?
I think the shuttle is more complicated by far than the early machines were. The Apollo command module, I thought, was a real handful. It was sort of like painting the Brooklyn Bridge. By the time I got to the end of it, there was something I'd forgotten at the beginning, and it was a constant process of education, of learning, And yet they tell me the shuttle is probably the equivalent of four command modules in complexity. So that's the main difference.
What about, you know, public support, comparing it, you know, in the past during Gemini, Apollo, and today? It seems as though in the past there was a lot more public support for going to the moon than even there is today for, say, putting a space station in orbit.
Well, I think there are some fundamental differences. One is that President Kennedy got very personally involved. Capitol Hill in those days was more apt to go along with White House programs than they are today, so it got the enthusiastic support of the Congress and I think the people. The difficulty with the space station, I believe, is that it's to be a research facility. It's to find out answers to difficult questions. And yet a lot of the politicians and budgeteers and bureaucrats want NASA to list exactly what the answers to those questions are before they fly this research laboratory. Well, that's simply not possible. You can't. That's the whole point in going is to have a research facility and to learn as much as we possibly can. I mean, we never would have had the invention of penicillin, for example, if the people doing the work had had to take that NASA-like approach and say in 20 pages why they were studying this particular mold or fungus and what the spin-offs of it might possibly be.
So, as a nation, we're really struggling to even identify a space policy. You know, you look at the shuttle space policy, and it's many people consider it a real disaster. What do you think we have to do to turn things around?
There is a fairly recent space policy issued by the Reagan White House, which makes a good deal of sense, and it includes sending people out into the universe, but that policy has to be backed up with a high priority by the president himself, by his staff, by the leaders in Congress. And I don't think that's happened because NASA is still appropriated less than 1% of the federal budget, and I think they need a little bit more to get an aggressive, good long-range program going.
Mike, thinking back over the past 30 years that NASA's been around, what do you think have been NASA's five greatest accomplishments or achievements?
I've always thought that the first lunar landing by the end of the decade was probably what NASA did best. I think, in a way, though, I think Apollo 8 was a more fundamentally important flight than Apollo 11. Apollo 8, you recall, was the one that first saw men breaking away, breaking the bonds of gravity, and reaching escape velocity. Another achievement that people forget, but is a little thing called Pioneer 10. Pioneer 10 is the first manufactured, first object made by humans to leave our solar system. And it's gone out past the orbit of Pluto and is headed out for all times, for infinity, out into the universe. I think the unmanned landing on Mars by the two Viking landers were, I think that was a very important achievement. So I guess I might say, this is a short and quick list, but Apollo's 8 and 11, Pioneer 10 and Viking. And then the fifth one I'm going to put in the future, and I'm going to say that's the Hubble Space Telescope.
Mike, now that you've thought about NASA's five major accomplishments, do you think that Mars should be NASA's next major initiative or endeavor?
Yes, I really do. I think Mars would be so important and so long-range a goal that it would pull in its wake a lot of things that NASA is trying to do today but not having much success with. For example, if you want to return to the moon, I think probably a better justification for it is that it be a way station on the way to Mars. I'm not saying that you have to have a colony on the moon or that you must return to the moon in order to reach Mars. You don't. But if Mars were your goal, you might very well discover that the most practical way to get there would be to build a lunar colony first. Clearly, if Mars were your goal, you'd need a space station. And the purposes to which that space station would be put would be much more clearly defined, and I think NASA would have an easier time justifying and obtaining the funds for a space station as a precursor to Mars, especially from the human factors physiological point of view. I think a lot of things would pull in the wake of a Mars initiative.
You know, Mike, do you think that the enthusiasm and the incitement on planet Earth will be as great for a mission to Mars as it was for the Apollo missions to the Moon?
I think so. I think Mars is a lot more interesting place than the Moon, although it is certainly true that the Viking results were disappointing in that they didn't find any life on Mars, no little green men. But the possibility exists that there used to be life on Mars. And I think it would be fascinating to go digging the surface, looking for fossils, and studying the planet from the surface to try to determine why you have these two almost twin planets, Earth and Mars, and why they turned out so differently. Why the water that one time dug deep channels in the surface of Mars, why did that dry up and blow away? Why did the Martian atmosphere become so thin? How did it dissipate? What can we learn about our own planet from studying this one that's had such a different history?
Do you think that the mission to Mars should be international in scope?
That would certainly be nice. Complicates an already complicated task, but I think it's worth a try, and I think we ought to try to put together not just a U.S.-Soviet joint venture, but rather one that includes a lot of other countries as well, the Japanese, the Europeans. Let anyone who can contribute technology and money throw it into the pot and do it in terms of humankind leaving this planet and establishing a settlement on Mars rather than any one nation doing it.
You know, thinking back at the time of the Apollo missions, there were very few nations involved in space exploration. And currently there are over 100.
Go ahead, David.
What would be the differences or the implications or influences versus many more people on a global scale involved in space exploration, you know, versus just a couple?
Well, of course, the more countries that are involved, I suppose the more popular, the greater support such a voyage would enjoy. It does the negative side of it is it makes it very difficult. It's difficult enough, I remember, from Project Apollo to get two or three American companies all working together harmoniously, never mind people who are divided by an ocean and different languages, different mores and cultures, even a different system for weights and measures.
One of my favorite quotes in your book is, "These are not ejection seats, but thrones, facing out on the universe, and we are wealthier than kings." By going into orbit, aboard, say, a Gemini spacecraft, or around the moon, or to the moon in the Apollo spacecraft, does it really change one's perspective of themselves and of the planet Earth?
I think certainly to go as far away as the moon and look back on the Earth certainly does affect your perspective. The Apollo command module had five windows in it, and when you're a quarter of a million miles away from Earth and you look out the window to find it, very common to be no Earth in any one of the five. The Earth is down under you, over your shoulder, somewhere else. So that's a strange sensation to have to maneuver around, even to find your home. And then when you see it, tiny as your thumbnail held out in front of you at arm's length, that sort of gets your attention. A beautiful sight, tiny, pristine, blue and white, very fragile-looking object, shining like a beautiful little headlight out there in the black velvet of space. It does change your perspective. It makes you think that we have to take better care of this little fragile entity, because it is fragile. And it also leads one in the direction of thinking about problems globally.
piggyback on your own career as a Gemini and an Apollo astronaut,
okay, I'm out.
I think you had a chance to take a couple of EVAs.
Spacewalks, yes, as they were called.
Right. Could you describe that? And was that perhaps in terms of the astronauts one of the scariest things that they have to do?
It wasn't. It was one of the most fun things that an astronaut gets to do. It wasn't really. Wasn't really scary, but it was. It's like being cooped up inside a bathhouse, let's say, and then suddenly being freed and allowed to go up and do a double back somersault off the high board. It was sort of that that feeling of release, of freedom, of getting out of a confined space, of having the whole world at your feet, to being able to see in all directions without confining spacecraft windows. It was a wonderful sense of liberation, of freedom, of floating, of being one with the whole universe.
And today, using the MMU versus an umbilical cord, I know it gives much more freedom, but it takes a different kind of training, does it not?
Yes, the that astronaut maneuvering unit is a miniature spacecraft in itself, and it's a wonderful gadget. It's flown like a spacecraft. You have each hand with its assigned task to either turn you this way or that way, up or down, or to move you backwards and forwards. And so the people who have, and I've never flown with it, but the people who have clearly really are enjoying themselves and have a lot more control over where they go and what they do than you do dangling out on the end of an umbilical cord.
One last question. If you had to give some words of wisdom to young people about the future and their part in space exploration, what might you encourage them, or how?
Well, I think whatever their field, whether it be space or some other field, I think to try to be the best in that field, to really strive for excellence, I think that gives people a feeling of confidence and a feeling of well-being, to know that they've put their everything into something and they're the best they can be at it. Certainly was true, I think, of the space program. And I think the space program will always be an area right on the edge of our knowledge, on the edge of our technology, on the frontier of physically and mentally of the things we do. And to me, it would be a fascinating area for young people to become involved with. Certainly as we get into the 21st century, we're going to see some remarkable advances in our space technology, and would be a good career to be part of that.
This is Lynn Bondurant saying goodbye from the NASA Lewis Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
And our thanks to the Lewis Research Center for that. Now, Jeffro Toll has a song for Michael Collins, Jeffrey and Me. And this song was written by Ian Anderson and released in 1970. The Jeffrey was Jeffrey Hammond, who in 1971 became Jeffro Toll's new bass player. Hammond had been a longtime friend of Ian Anderson, and this song commemorates Michael Collins.
Watery eyes of the last sighing seconds, blue reflections mute and dim, beckon tearful child of wonder to repentance of the sin. And the blind and lusty lovers of the great eternal light, go on believing nothing, since something has to die. And the apes' curiosity, money, power, wins, and the yellow soft mountains move under him. I'm with you, we'll be right back. And the lim-faced hungry viewers fight to fasten with their eyes.
And now it's over to Purple Haze.